Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and many welcomes to the LSE. My name is Matthew Dancona, and it's my great pleasure, on behalf of the Times, to welcome you all to this special Times Dillon's lecture. It's often said that the mark of great scholarship is that it makes us see things differently. It makes the familiar seem strange and vice versa. And for that reason, we're very fortunate this evening to have with us one of the most exciting historians working in the world today, Simon Sharma, who's going to be talking to us about his new book, Landscape and Memory. Professor Sharma was born and educated in this country, but he's now working at Columbia University, where he's the Old Dominion Professor of the Humanities. He's already achieved so much and travelled so far as a scholar that I shan't even attempt to summarise his work. But it's fair to say that he is one of that small group of professional historians working today who's achieved the crossover to a mass readership without surrendering an ounce of his scholarly integrity, and I hope he won't mind me saying, without surrendering his taste for scholarly controversy. It was with his study of the 17th century Dutch culture, The Embarrassment of Riches, in 1987, that he first became known to the world outside the academic grove, and he completed the process triumphantly with citizens. This monumental survey of the human and inhuman face of the French Revolution not only won the coveted NCR Book Award, but was a runaway bestseller all over the world, and it still sells extremely well. In the 6 years since it was published, it has become one of the best-known and highly regarded historical works of our time. In the process, Professor Sharma's work, a narrative skill, and the depth of his knowledge have become familiar to hundreds of thousands of readers, and the manner in which his critics have attacked him has merely recommended him all the more to his thousands of fans. Now he has turned his sights on the history and significance of landscape, which he describes intriguingly as the work of the mind, built up as much from strata of memory as from layers of rock. Landscape and Memory is quite simply one of the most ambitious books ever written about man and the natural world, and it coincides with a major BBC series which will be beginning on BBC Two on April the 22nd. Those of you who've already read it will know that it is an extraordinary guided tour through the world's darkest forests, its strangest rivers, and most sequestered mountains, in the company of a master storyteller. Those who haven't will, I'm sure, be eager to buy a copy, and Professor Sharma has kindly agreed to sign copies after he's taken questions, which will happen outside the hall at the end of the lecture. Meanwhile, let's give him the chance to tell us all about it. Please join me in welcoming Simon Sharma.
Thank you very much, Matthew, for that very generous introduction. What do you mean, taste for controversy? All I want is a quiet life, really. Historians are notoriously bad tourists, the torment of guides trying to earn their living without an intervention from some professorial type who breaks off smirking only to offer disingenuously polite interruption, as in, oh, I think it must mean 1695 for the double recall Phil Cannon-Shirley had been invented in 1691. And our imaginations are too greedy, our scanning equipment too restless, ever really to allow much time for innocent tourist absorption. So even at Yad Vashem, the Holocaust memorial on the outskirts of Jerusalem a few weeks ago, even in a place where innocence is, in any case, rather beside the point, I was careful, or tried to be careful, not to annex that place to my own historical preoccupations. But then again, there was one place in the grounds where I found it impossible to help myself, really. I couldn't help myself, and I still can't. Near the entrance to Moshe Safdie's unbearably beautiful memorial to children consumed by the Nazi extermination is a sapling, perhaps 7 foot high, in good shape, considering it's a European maple, a variety not really suited to the dry, dusty soil of the Judean hills. But like the European survivors of the Holocaust in Israel, it's been transplanted for a purpose. It is, you see, a cutting from a maple that was planted on Tu B'Shvat, the New Year for Trees, in 1944 in the concentration camp of Theresienstadt in Czech, Terezin, I'm sure you know, about 40 miles northeast of Prague in the foothills of the Bohemian Tatras. Theresienstadt, I expect you know, is not an extermination centre like Treblinka or Auschwitz. Birkenau was better, and it was worse. Better because it had no gas chambers or crematoria. Worse because it was deliberately designed as a place of deceptive hope, a model village complete with libraries, art classes, chamber music concerts, all calculated to impress the International Red Cross, which it did, before the inmates were taken to a lower-level camp, starved, beaten, shot, or packed off to the annihilation sheds of Poland. Worse than them, then, because of the obscene cruelty of false hope, and it was in one such moment, in the spring, that Ilse Teicher, a schoolteacher in Terezin, gathered her class about her in the springtime of 1944 on the festival of Tu Bishvat, the new year for trees, and planted a maple in the loamy soil of Bohemia. The tree survived. I saw it there myself 30 years ago. So by now, it must be a very mature growth, maybe 50 feet tall, perhaps a year for every one passed since the liberation of the camp. But neither the children who planted the tree nor the teacher who helped them survived. And a few years ago, a group from a Montreal charity decided to take a cutting from the Terezin maple and replant it before the children's memorial in Yad Vashem, where it now stands, modestly grey and tawny-barked against the yellow Jerusalem limestone. I tell you this as an introductory story because much of my book is concerned with the ways in which our culture has drawn consolation from the cycle of vegetation, has adopted it as the emblem of immortality. And the presence of a maple tree in a place of grief and death and memory, grief and memory, is so very striking because, strictly speaking, such symbols of a tree are in utter opposition to Orthodox Jewish tradition. In that tradition, both in the Bible and the Talmud, there's no concept of the afterlife as a paradise garden. The paradise garden is a place from which we were expelled through our sin. The strictly Jewish cemetery is required to be merely a place of waiting, pending the coming of the end of days, the appearance of the Messiah, and the installation of the reign of justice. On that day, the dead are to wake. So the rabbi tells us their resting place ought to be as austere as possible, a place of stones, utterly unornamented by any decoration, botanical or crafted. Travel back from Terezin to the medieval Jewish cemetery in Prague, and you can see exactly such a place. Go back to the Mount of Olives above the Garden of Gethsemane from Yad Vashem, and you can see another such place. Holes cut at the back of the stones to ensure a timely exit for the dead on the day of the Messiah. Which is what makes the adoption of the arboreal memorial even more powerful, I think, a testimony to the need built into almost all cultures to connect our human fate with the cycle of nature, notwithstanding the formal prohibition of priests and rabbis. It was, of course, precisely because burial amidst a grove was a pagan, especially a Phoenician, practice that rabbis and sages so strictly forbade it. What they would say to the memorial parks that line the Garden State Freeway in New Jersey, not far from where I live, is quite beyond imagining. But then, more than burial practices have changed over the centuries of Jewish tradition. Tu Bishvat, the new year for trees, was, in its biblical origin, it simply marked the completion of the tithing period, the Bible tells us, an innocuous way, rather nice way, to celebrate the end of the tax year, taxes, of course, being indicated on a wooden rod very often. It was only during the Zionist settlement of Palestine in this century, with its emphasis on the transformation of the landscape, indeed on the creation of a new kind of Jew in a new kind of landscape, that Tu Bishvat turned into an arbor day. My generation all grew up in the 50s, wrongly assuming this had been the case all along. So accustomed were we to photographs and newsreels of bronzed pioneers, youths troweling holes in the soil and planting row after row of seedlings, pines, cedars, cypresses, and ubiquitous sand-fixing eucalyptus. All trees that embodied an act of reclamation, both topographical and human. Now, for a Jewish boy growing up on the streets and buses of London, round here, among other places, it was hard not to take this kind of vegetable nationalism, a patriotic replanting of trees and people, as somehow peculiarly self-conscious, even incongruous and artificial. It's not just the entire experience of the Jewish diaspora was necessarily one of severance, so I used to suppose, from the land, or at least from ownership of the land since the Roman Empire. It's that we've been conditioned to imagine virtually the whole experience of Jews in Eastern Europe, particularly since the exile, is in some essential way urban. So that the shtetls of Russia, Poland, and Lithuania, for example, while in many cases self-evidently villages, have often been thought of as urban hamlets marooned in an alien countryside, the Jewish inhabitants practicing essentially urban trades and crafts. This axiom that a Jewish villager was somehow an oxymoron was best exemplified by a remark made by the eminent Marxist historian and biographer of Trotsky and Stalin, Isaac Deutscher, who, when asked by an innocent graduate student in Cambridge when Deutscher was giving the Trevelyan lectures, goodness, I think in the late 60s, when he was asked to say something about his Polish roots, snapped back the retort, "Roots, roots, trees have roots, Jews have legs." So I thought, until I myself became interested at the outset of doing research for Landscape and Memory. The idea of the book took its cue from the first chapter, The Embarrassment of Riches, where I try to explore history as geography, the ways in which the 17th century Dutch conceived their common identity as a response to their watery geography, a cue I was very much prompted by Jan Huizinga's extremely beautiful essay called The Netherlands in the 17th Century, still, I think, up there, published by Fontana, I believe, and I hope in print. I wanted to try and understand in Landscape and Memory the ways in which culture has reimagined land, the soil from which the materials of subsistence are extracted, as landscape, the place we have immemorially imagined as home, as father or motherland, or in watery, fluvial sense, as our source, the fons sapientiae, the source of wisdom, the fountain builders of the Renaissance called it. The project in its beginning was an effort to sketch in the mental topography of nationalism, to see how similar or dissimilar were the invocations of the German forest Heimat or the English Greenwood, for example. But the proper borderlines between a scholarly and a personal project kept dissolving. Because it seemed important to begin with the myth of the primeval forest. In a rather literal cast of mind, I wanted to see an area of woodland that still purported to be authentically primeval. I'm going to try and dim here, and my dimming is, of course, not working. I'm doing the opposite. I'd warned my hosts here. Okay, thanks. Well, maybe. Okay. Oh, to hell with dimming. Let's actually see if we can. Let's get us a. Okay. All right. If somebody's an idea about getting a little more darkness, that would help us see the. Let me try. Let me be really daring and try dim too. Is that going? Lights, okay. Seems about the same. Okay, fine. If you can help me with that, that'd be terrific. Anyway, you can see the pictures, I hope. There are countless national parks in Europe, but there is only one, apparently only one true wildwood, an authentic, documented anyway, let me get me more focus on that. Okay. An authentically primeval forest that's certainly never been cut, cleared, or replanted. Its site is Białowieża, by the village of the White Tower, about 30 miles northeast of Białystok. Today, the frontier between Poland and Belarusia cuts right through the forest, but for centuries it lay deep in ancestral Lithuania, not the Baltic Republic, but the Polish Lithuania, celebrated and invoked in the poetry of Mickiewicz and Czesław Miłosz. Get up in the mist of a springtime dawn and you could still wander alone in a startling and undisturbed ecology, a great vegetable ossuary where prone carcasses of dead hornbeams and spindle trees lie gently rotting in deep and scummy peat bogs, where others lean at crazy angles supported by vast trunks of centenarian oaks. There's wild garlic and wild honey in these scented woods, countless varieties of fungus spreading riotously among the wood mold, beaver lodges piled up beside alder trees standing next to black water. And if you're very lucky and very quiet, you might get a glimpse of elk and lynx, or even, as we did, as you see on the right, the Lithuanian bison. Sorry to inflict my holiday snaps on you. The Joubre, on its way to feed off the fragrant Hyrachloe odorata, the meadow grass that grows in the spaces opened by the death of ancient trees. Of course, those of you who know very old forests know that they're paradoxically much lighter than you would imagine from reading grim fairy tales, because since they're allowed to fall and crash, they open up these beautiful sort of groves until suckers turn into mature trees. The biodiversity of the Puszcza Białowieża, the Białowieża wilderness, proclaims its great antiquity, its miraculous escape from the scientific forestry of the Enlightenment in the 19th century, with an obsession with taxonomically ordered plantations graduated by age and species into uniform blocks of trees accessible for cereal harvesting. From at least the 15th century, Białowieża was recognized as a habitat uniquely packed with species, like the bison, described in ancient geographies, like those of Pliny and Strabo, but which have become extinct elsewhere. And this sense of the place as a living biological Wunderkammer, I think we've got, yes, actually, let me move on here. There's in fact, a print taken from a wonderful book. Let me give you a little bit more. A little bit more focus. This is a print taken from a really marvelous, a marvelous book, actually, written by Tsar Nicholas I's forester, a man called Julius von Brinken, who I write about in the Polish chapter of the book, who produces a glorious sort of inventory of the species, both botanical and animal, in the forest, and a kind of memoir of his own experience there. And he's simply showing a kind of the process of a hunt, because it was, oddly enough, because this forest was so coveted as one of the most extraordinary hunting grounds between the Urals and the Atlantic, that it was kept in such good shape and passed on from ruler to ruler and generation to generation. Ironically, as I say, it's been the persistence of this most ancient pastime of death into the age of the nation state that guaranteed the survival of the forest. But it also made Białowieża a place bitterly and brutally contested between warring cultures, each of which... get you a bit more focus there. Let's get me more focus here if I can. Oh, dear. All right, you're seeing those graves through the mist, actually. There are graves in the woodland, Polish, German, Russian, Jewish, some marked, many more unmarked. You can see them better in the black and white slide on the right, the winter shot. For the Poles in particular, the immemorial longevity of the forest serves as a correlate of their own sense of tragic imperishability. But we're not just talking poetic metaphors here, powerful though they are in the construction of national memory and identity. For each time the Polish state collapsed or was eaten alive by predatory neighbours, thrice in the 18th century, twice in the 19th century, twice more in the 20th century, it was the forest, this forest in particular and others to the north and south, that provided shelter, camouflage and graveyards for the partisans. So let me get a little bit now. Really must try and get you a little bit more. Okay. Somebody's over there. Can somebody help me with the focus? Because this focus switch really is not working at all. Is there somebody who can actually... Yeah, thanks. There should be a manual focus on there, and that really be a great help. Or maybe even on the lens. Is it jammed? Okay, that's great. Thank you very much. Good. Okay, and the other one's now gone. Okay. Great. Thanks so much. Yeah, it's not actually focusing. Let me give it... Okay. Let me see if I can do it here. Sorry. Is that helping at all? It's not. Is it worse? Okay. This... Okay. Interactive lecturing. I love it. Okay, thank you all. Artur Grotka's series of lithographs in the 1860s, which you're seeing, like Anna Mickiewicz's great poem, Pan Tadeusz, identify the forest depths, the commonwealth of bison and bear, as a place of freedom and death, and of consummation and rebirth. Hope you can see that self-evidently from these great lithographs. The Calvary, as Polish poets said in the 19th century, of what paradoxically, the greatest Polish poets have always celebrated this particular area as Lithuania. But it's precisely because the Poles do not have a monopoly on the national mystique of the ancestral forest that the border woodlands have seen so much trouble. Even the European culture, which of necessity was least territorial, the Jews, could actually claim the Lithuanian woods as their heim in Yiddish. It's long been recognized that Jews were prominent in the timber industry of the Russian Empire, hauling and selling lumber to the Tsarist authorities for railway sleepers and building materials, or like Isaiah Berlin's family exporting it west from the Baltic port of Riga. But follow the Niemen River upstream 100 years ago and you would have found Jews actively engaged at every level of the business, right down to the lumberjack colonies that dotted the river between Grodno and Kovno. My mother's own family was one such clan which built a house overlooking the river where they hauled logs from the outskirts, the skirts of the Pustja Augustowska, just a bit north of Białowieża, and rafted them downstream to Kaunas, to Kovno, using dog sleds when the river iced over. Given this long history, the idea of Jewish partisan bands, some of them escapees from Treblinka and the ghettos of Białystok and Warsaw, fighting in the forest alongside national resistance seems less improbable. But it's true that the importance of the forest mythology has been much less crucial to Jewish than to Polish or German national memory. And if I had more time and you were unhappily captive, I could add to that list of sylvan myths and memories the Greenwood of England and the American wilderness, which I write about in the book. Nor, of course, is the woodland the only kind of symbolic landscape that serves this purpose of supplying an emotive topography for the imagined community, as, of course, Benedict Anderson has called it, of the nation. As a small boy, I grew up on the grimy Essex bank of the Thames estuary, and though the cockle boats of Leon Sea were nothing much to stir historical romance even in a seven-year-old, I'd look out at the sludge-brown water where the tidal river met the sea, and long before I'd heard of Conrad or Kipling or even Arthur Bryant, would imagine it as the great artery of Imperial Albion. Tilbury and Gravesend, after all, were not so very, very far away, and I imagined Elizabeth I, much resembling Dame Flora Robeson, smiting her armoured breast and exhorting her troops to repel the armada-born tercios, enemies alike, I noted with grim satisfaction, to Jews and Englishmen. I hope then I needn't labour the significance of imagined or indeed actual landscapes in a psychology of national allegiance. Its most glaring instance in America, the song America the Beautiful, was composed in an innocent time when the extension of territorial nationality was unencumbered by thoughts of all those whom it displaced, indeed, of course, exterminated, still less of their Native American imagined and mythical landscapes. Tis, after all, an inventory of topographical blessings received like school prizes from the providential headmaster for rising to the position of top empire. In a darker vein, the atavistic obsessions of Blut und Boden, Daré's phrase, blood and soil, as he exemplified in a classic piece of kind of Nazi landscape by Werner Peiner called Alas, Steaming Furrows, on the left, persisted through the 19th and 20th centuries. So that one of the most recurrent motifs in the iconography of war propaganda across the North Sea were competing inspirational myths of homelands, the sempiternal limestone village, nestling, of course, in the Cotswolds, on the one hand, in Frank Newbold's wonderful World War II poster in the Imperial War Museum on the right, or in the kind of thing that you see in the Pina on the left, or extraordinary paintings, I expect you know, of frighteningly muscled livestock, actually, in the German sense. As we speak, of course, here, it's difficult for us to understand, I think, some of other competing visions, say, of Serbian Orthodox Christians, Croatian Catholics, Bosnian Muslims, that they have the very same land and landscape, but quite differently imagined when given the gloss of historical and religious experience. But of one thing we can be sure, they conflict and coincide, as of course do Palestinian and Israeli visions of their respective homelands, in ways programmed for sadness. To think of the historical moment when nationalism became most obsessed with sketching its distinctive landscape is to think automatically of the Romantics. And while for both Polish and German history, That impression is obviously correct. The original moment when patriotic identity was imprinted with topography can be dated, I think, with some precision, 3 centuries earlier, in the beginning of the 16th century. It was in the late 15th and early 16th centuries that the primitive forest was claimed as an ancestral homeland, and in both cases, it was taken not only for a people, but against a big state. Namely, of course, the universalism of the Roman Empire. That was the enemy. Around 1520, the young humanist poet Mikolaj Husovski, the son of a forester and gamekeeper to the Jagiellonian kings of Poland, Lithuania, composed an extraordinary Latin poem on the Lithuanian bison. I'm showing you a wonderful print from Comrade Gessner's Tierbuch on the left. The poem is called De Statura Feritate Aquinatione Bisontis, the bison poem. And the 50-page epic was meant for the ears of Pope Leo X, an enthusiastic hunter and zoological collector. But while Husovsky's poem was evidently meant to appeal to Leo's taste for the exotic, it was not only an exhaustive description of the anatomy, behavior, and folklore of the fearsomely shaggy ungulate, it was also a eulogy for its native habitat, the barbarian wild forests of old Lithuania, a region that had been only converted to Christianity at the end of the 14th century. While Husovsky was himself impeccably pious and in Rome as a protege of the Polish archbishop, his poem bragged of the primitive martial vigour of the Sarmatian woods against the effete condescension of the Latin Italians. In the last respect, Husovsky's bison poem echoed a much more famous oration by the German humanist, Konrad Keltis. Keltis had also, as it happens, studied at the beautiful Jagiellonian University of Krakow, though he was far less taken with Polish scenery than with its women, one of whom, the married Hasselina, inspired him to some of the most startlingly erotic poetry of the Latin Renaissance. But it was in a speech and address to the University of Ingolstadt in 1492 that Keltis summoned the youth of Germany to confound the conventional Italian-Latin stereotype that his countrymen, Germans, were all uncultivated boors. No, no, he said, they should henceforth saturate themselves in poetry, art, and philosophy that they might surpass their detractors. So it was a kind of attempt to sort of be German by outdoing those who patronize them as wild men, roughnecks. What's interesting is that 7 years later, that line of defense of Germanness in Keltis' own work utterly had changed. Defensiveness and nascent national pride were braided together throughout that early Ingolstadt address, but the time that he came to lecture on Tacitus at the University of Vienna, 4 years later, Keltis had gone on the offensive for his claims for the superiority of German and northern culture and its landscape over the decadent, ruined south. His source, of course, was the Germania, the first of all Tacitus's writings to be rediscovered by the humanists, Italian humanists like Poggio Bracciolini and Aeneas Sylvius. As Keltis well knew, the Germania was not merely the dispassionate... Oh, I want to have that back, excuse me. Oops, sorry, I can't get it back. Good. And I want this one on. I'm showing you here, you'll have to forgive me, I'm cheating here slightly, the best engravings, the most wonderful engravings are actually from almost 100 years later, from an edition of the Germania by the great Dutch-German humanist Philip Cluverius, Philip von Cluver, about 1610. But you'll hope, take my word for it, that they're very comparable, except much more beautiful, than the kind of illustrations of the noble savagery of the Germans in their wood dwellings that appeared in the kind of editions that followed Keltis' great commentaries. As Keltis well knew, the Germania was not merely a kind of dispassionate ethnography of the primitive Teutonic tribes that were the perennial thorn in the side of Imperial Rome in Tacitus's lifetime in the late 1st and early 2nd century AD. In many respects, of course, Tacitus's book was a subtle autocritique of Rome itself. Germany was everything Rome was not, for better and worse. If it was rude and unpolished, it had also been uncorrupted by luxury and urbanity. If its dwellings were timbered huts rather than elegantly marbled houses, let me try and get you a bit more focus. Any chance? Whoops. It's amazing. Let's try and press. Is that better? Oh, it is. Back? Okay. All right. Thank you. This is great. It's like, you know. Okay. It's like parking. Back a bit, down a bit. Whoa! When I used to park on cross-channel ferries, you know, it was always actually back a bit, back a bit, back a bit, bang, whoa, used to follow, and slammed into them. You know. Germany was everything Rome was not, if it was rude and unpolished. Oh, it was. The crucial thing was its rawness, and its rawness sort of defined by its closeness to the woods. It's important to the Germans who reread Tacitus then that he describes its dwelling as timbered huts rather than marble houses, wood preferred to masonry. And because of that, he claimed that those who lived in those houses retained simple virtues. Their children were suckled at their mother's breasts. They any luck we have. Whoops, no, I'm going to go back to that. There we go. There's the breastfeeding scene from the Germania. They ate in common, as you saw earlier, shared property, and were quick to offer hospitality to strangers. Chastity and martial courage, note the wooden armor there, the wooden shields, were second nature to them. Indeed, through their wooden huts and open-air sacred groves, just flick through some, without being too bewildering, there's an image from an earlier edition of Germania, of the grove worship. They were still close to nature, indeed were children of nature. Tacitus himself, at the very outset of the Germania, is anything but flattering to the German habitat, which he describes as silvis horrida, bristling forests and stinking swamps. But the generation of 16th century geographers that followed Celtis were his students, like Johannes Aventinus and others, looked much more kindly on their native scenery. They went back to the description of the great Hercynian forest given in Pliny and Caesar, which had once extended unbroken, apparently, it was said, from the Bohemian woods in the east to the Odenwald in the far northwest, and they saw that as the cradle of national virtue. And indeed, on the right, you see, I hope you can see it, it's reproduced in the book too, a wonderful little picture by Erhard Etzlaub of Nuremberg surrounded by forests. The fact was that all those forests had long since ceased to be. They'd been cleared. But, of course, in the mind of these 16th century humanist geographers, wanted to think of a German kiwis, a German city-state, in fact, as serendipitously surrounded by a barrier, a forest barrier. It was those kinds of barriers in the way they reread their ancient sort of birth certificate of Germany, which had prevented Latin, the language, and Roman law from penetrating deep into Germany, had kept their distinctiveness, always defined against Roman universalism, German particularism. What all those writers really did, oddly enough, again, was to borrow the model of the old Latin civic eulogies, the Laudati, that writers like Chancellor Bruni had bestowed on Florence and translated it not only to Nuremberg, but to the countryside surrounding them, producing marvelous descriptions of regional botany, one of which was called the Flora Hercynia. The countryside they described was there, for example, on the right, a wonderful plate from Sebastian Münster's great cosmography, the Black Forest, you can see. And it actually says, interestingly, Negra Silva, the Black Forest, a part of the Hercynian Woods. The Hercynian Woods, as an unbroken forest, if it ever existed, had long since ceased to exist. But you understand, of course, that was the way they felt about Germany, that what had happened to Germany was a catastrophic accident that had pulverized it into innumerable principalities. If you could reimagine an unbroken woodland, you could reimagine an indivisible Germany yet again. The countryside they described and extolled was thick with game and the riches of the timber economy. It was everything that deforested Italy and the Latin South was not. And what went for topography, the German humanists implied, also went for manners and mores. Many of the choreographers, many of the geographers, these kinds of geographers, as you see, were very handsomely illustrated with engravings or woodcuts, not only with maps, but also evocations of the flora and fauna and local arts and crafts. But it now seems clear that the birth of autonomous landscape painting and drawing. That's to say, when I say autonomous landscape, I mean landscapes that have finally been freed from the dominance of sacred narrative or classical history. This too owed its stimulus in great part to the connection between native geography and the assertion of patriotic German Christian virtue. And Christopher Wood's wonderful book on Altdorfer has fascinating things to say about that. Albrecht Altdorfer. Oh, I want that back. Go back. There we go. And here are two Altdorfers. Oh, God, it'd be wonderful if we could actually have the lights out somehow. Is there no way to get more darkness from the wall switches there? Okay, it would be terrific. No? Okay, all right. Somebody could do that. It'd be really very kind. Thank you. It's impossible to see what really great Altdorfer on the right is, because my switches seem to produce mehr Licht rather than less. Anyway, as Altdorfer is an important figure because he's in Vienna at the same time that Keltis is giving these lectures on Tacitus, and he certainly is very familiar with Keltis' students and with these wonderful geography books. Both he and other artists in the so-called Danube school, like Wolf Huber, produce in the first two decades of the 16th century representations, like the spruce tree you see on the left, of the wooded coniferous forests of the Wienerwald and Böhmerwald that engage with exactly the same definition of Germanic distinctiveness that belonged to Keltis' reinterpretation of Tacitus. The crucial document, which we might be able to see if we can get the lights out, is on the right, and you can certainly, it's actually on the jacket of Landscape and Memory and handsomely reproduced in a colour plate inside, is the little St. George, painted on parchment, glued to limewood. Limewood, the German medium par excellence, as Michael Baxendall has taught us, full of associations of the sacred and organic. And the little painting really, I think, constitutes a revolutionary statement against the assumptions, thank you so much, against the assumptions about history landscape that prevailed in the Latin South. Instead of a deeply recessed space in which the narrative is organized along the line of perspective, Altdorfer tilts what would normally have been the horizontal background of a forest 180 degrees so that it lies like a curtain wall parallel to the picture plane. The effect of this startling move is to invert the conventional order of things so that the ostensible action of the history, St. George, not exactly slaying, but rather sort of saying good morning to the dragon, really, is actually occluded, even strangled by the luxuriant undergrowth, an effect reinforced by the amazing lengths to which Altdorfer has gone to reproduce foliation. Incredible sense of the density of sort of organic, tendril-like sort of growth of particular leaves, wonderfully lit on their edge to give them an extraordinary sense of kind of vitality. More than any other image I can think of, the panel has made the Teutscher Baumann as one of these writers. Bohemius described them. The forests themselves is the protagonist of the action here. The publication of German editions of Tacitus's great annals after the Germania supplied this generation of patriotic humanists with another story. So we can get a little bit. There we go. That define their shared ancestry. The great battle of the Teutoburgwald, the Teutoburg Forest, in AD 7, when the legions of Publius Quintilius Varus were annihilated by the crudely armed soldiers of Arminius. The Hermannschlacht, Arminius Hermann in German, and he's called Hermann for the first time in this kind of writing in the 16th century, actually took place before Tacitus begins his history, and its details are only known to us through the chronicle of Velleius Paterculus, though the Romans themselves had the now lost, evidently wonderful history of Pliny the Elder. But Tacitus's unforgettable pages, including some of the most alarming and powerful descriptions of combat ever written, were haunted by the ghosts of Roman soldiers destroyed in the forest swamps. Indeed, on the eve of a battle, their general of this later vindicating army, Germanicus, confusingly called Germanicus, the Roman, is literally visited by the nightmare of Varus's ghost, rising gruesomely from the bog, one blood-spattered arm reaching out to pull him down. Before Germanicus finally prevails in AD 17, he has to take the battle to the woods themselves to trap the German troops with their own tactics. And even then, Arminius is destroyed not by defeat, but by the treachery of conspirators among his own people. especially when compared with the conduct of the Emperor Tiberius and the Roman aristocracy, the saintly Germanicus always accepted in Tacitus's account. Tacitus actually bestows a glowing encomium on the German hero, Arminius Hermann, whom Tacitus calls, in a phrase that echoes down all the centuries of German history, as the Liberator Germaniae. The story of this battle, the Hermannschlacht, was of course meat and drink to the humanists I've been talking about in their search of a founding father. It's especially useful to Protestant rebels like Ulrich von Hutten, who were unlikely to take the line of German emperors, Ottonian, Swabian, or Hohenstaufen, as suitable precedents. Arminius, on the other hand, Arminius provides a perfect exemplum through whom people like Ulrich von Hutten, Lutheran rebel, could define Deutschland against Rome, both the Roman Empire and the Roman papacy. It's not surprising to find von Hutten then actually writing a dialogue called Arminius, in which he speaks through the mouth of the tribal hero. Right, so these two traditions, the Hermannschlacht in the Teutoburg forest and the birth of primitive virtue in the bigger Hercynian forest, persist through the High Renaissance and the Baroque period, even though they become more poeticized and classicized in the form of their expression. Some of you may know plays like Klopstock and many others devoted to the story of the Hermannschlacht. But when an interest in the shared genealogy, history, and ethnography, and indeed geography of an ancient Germany revived in the middle of the 1700s, forest scenery and the fetish of the Teutonic oak became obligatory features of patriotic topography. In Göttingen, for example, the circle of the Heinbund, the sacred grove poets, devoted themselves to modernized versions of what they claim was medieval woodland lore. Enormous oaks began to figure again in elaborately allegorical paintings as the emblem of Germania itself, or as the ancient hiding place from which a new Barbarossa might be aroused from slumber. The most startlingly original, I believe, of all German graphic artists of this period, Carl Wilhelm Kolbe, prints you see on the left, acquired the nickname of Der Eiche, the oak, and used his long romantic rambles in the woods near Dessau as a starting point for these etchings that explicitly recalled the woodland scenes of the Altdorfer generation, strangling isolated figures in massive enveloping vegetation, as you see. No artist, of course, actually, I want to say just a little bit, but time is getting on, made this more powerful, of course, than Caspar David Friedrich. But let me just go back. There we go. There's Friedrich for you, the great chasseur in the forest. If we go back, so that you wonder what that is. In the 19th century, I want to come back to Friedrich in just a second, actually, but of course one of the great projects to commemorate the Hermannschlacht, and I talk about this in detail in the book, so I won't linger on it here, is the decision to actually build a great monument near what was thought to be the site of the Teutoburg forest near Detmold. And here is one of the early sketches, actually, for the Hermannsdenkmal. And one of the early designers of such a monument, the great architect Schinkel, was determined that it should be seen to almost arise out of the forest vegetation, that the statue itself, with its cupola and temple, should be surrounded by woodlands. Kiefer's painting, actually, is incredibly important because it was painted in 1812-13, exactly the time when Friedrich's painting, when Friedrich himself was very much engaged in the Freiheitskrieg, the War of Liberation against Germany. We have here Germany against Rome yet again, except instead of the old Roman Empire, we have the new Roman Empire of Napoleon Bonaparte, indicated by the chasseur with his back to us, with a very stylized helmet, which was indeed a Napoleonic helmet, but very much something that would be almost reminiscent of those Roman legions. The whole thing's an elaborate allegory on actually the consuming of yet another Romanism by the German woods. Here, the cut tree stands, we know from one of Friedrich's own letters, for the fallen martyrs of the War of Liberation. The raven is, of course, singing the songs that ravens like to sing to the doomed warrior. And even though it's winter, captivity in the Napoleonic Empire, the firs are emblems for Friedrich, there's no doubt, of resurrection. And more particularly, of course, what's happening here is a track through the forest called in German a Holzweg, which not only means a path through the woods, but has the kind of punning sense of a cul-de-sac, literally a dead end. And German soldiers are here. All of Hermann's army is here. But they, of course, have been turned into trees, which ultimately will envelop the hubristic ambitions of the Napoleonic Roman, new Roman Empire. And on, I believe, with a sort of relentless self-reinforcement through the 19th... Oh, dear, I do want that one back again. Sorry about this. There's, in fact, a wonderful print of Kaiser Wilhelm going to see the model for the Hermannschlacht there, in built by von Bandel. On and on, with relentless self-enforcement through the 19th, through the 20th century, march these metaphors of death and life, rot and rebirth, the olive, the Roman olive and the German oak, Roma and Germania, all the way, in fact, to Anselm Kiefer's materialized epic evocations of the bloodied woods of the Hermannschlacht. A whole series of painting, and there's Kiefer's representation of himself in the woodland, and of course those of you who know German will know that one version of the word Kiefer means a fir tree. And I want to make the case that in at least one respect, Kiefer is actually quoting directly from Friedrich, but with his own gloss through the experience of his father's generation of German history. But at any rate, the Hermannschlacht obsesses Kiefer in the 70s. And he is living, actually comes to live in the Odenwald, the westernmost arm of the old Hercynian forest, even though there's not very much left of it when he arrives. Amazing series of paintings, woodcuts, and so-called books made out of wood, sometimes not, create a pantheon of Germany's heroes, cultural and martial. Their features made literally wooden within the grain of the timber. And here I'm just showing you, I have a number of plates in the book, but there's an extraordinary book in the Boston Museum of Fine Arts called The Hermannschlacht. The front of the book is actually, and again I reproduce those, the front of the book is actually a strange little screen of forest, which Kiefer identifies as the Teutoburg Burgwald itself, which he's taken in a kind of rather dimly focused black and white photo. And you open the book, which is enormous, and what you see are these extraordinarily planked woodcut impressions. Some people argue that Kiefer is really great as a graphic artist rather than as a painter. Not sure that's true, but this is a very great piece of graphic work indeed. And it was a curator's nightmare. It was a summer day when I saw it, and the curator just said, "Oh God, I suppose so," and sort of opened the leaves of the book for me. And he said, "They never dry, they never dry." Kiefer's used, you know, whole lengths of tree timber to sort of plank out these images, of course, which are meant to be the light flickering through violent sort of forest interior. And he's used a strange pitch-like resinous ink instead of normal ink so that the pages don't, as she said, never really dry. And even interleaved very carefully, when you open them, bits, you know, fall off and scab and peel, very much, of course, in the way Kiefer wants to represent a kind of organic, vegetable, self-decomposing kind of work of art. They hate it in Boston, though they love the work of art. And at the end of that, there is an extraordinary, what Kiefer actually literally, when he was describing this in English to one interviewer, called his blockheads, which are literally heads of the heroes of German history, or anti-heroes, German military figures, ending with the head of Hermann himself, Arminius himself, done as a grainy woodcast. It's a really extraordinary thing. And the last, the greatest of the series, which we have as a gatefold in the book, is the painting called Varus. There are many versions of this. Greatest one, there's a great one in Amsterdam in the Stedelijk Museum. In Eindhoven, in the Stedelijk von Abba Museum. This is it. And there's another very good, interesting one, in partly painted, partly printed, in the Art Institute of Chicago. You can see here that actually, I hope you buy my line, I'm perfectly open to your not doing so, that Kiefer knows and indeed is quoting the Friedrich, but instead, of course, of that snow-brushed forest path, the path actually is grimy and filthy and the trees are deformed and the entire painting almost literally drips with blood, the evidence of Kiefer's own sensitivity to historical narration. Indeed, he of course has returned in a protest against what he thought to be the self-referential narcissism of colour field painting, of abstract and minimalist painting in the 60s to the traditional concerns of figurative and historical narrative. I wish I could say more, but there absolutely isn't time. Anyway, While one Hauman in the Hauman's Denkmal was enshrined in stone, as you saw a little earlier, at the western edge of the old Hercynian woods, another Hauman dreamed dreams of woodland mastery in the east. This other Hauman, Göring, of course, made sure that virtually the first act on his coming to power in 1933 was to make himself Reichsforstmeister. And as chief forest minister of Germany, he appointed another man, Ulrich Schörping, as his deputy, whose family, Schörping's family, had been royal foresters to the Hohenzollern kings and emperors. The art and the academic science of forestry, of course, had flourished in Germany as nowhere else in Europe, though there had been a brilliant, highly politicized Polish journal, as it happens, called Silvan, published in Warsaw during the Congress Kingdom in the first half of the 19th century. But the Third Reich, painfully, really, outdid all its predecessors in making the nationalist ecology of the ewige Deutsches Wald, the eternal, enduring German woods, an official obsession. A goodly number of forestry professors from Munich and other major academic centers not only joined the Nazi party, but actually ended up as officers in the SS during the war, along with Schörping himself. Together they helped Göring dream of a new arboreal edition of the Drang nach Osten, the extension of the woodlands of East Prussia through the Lithuanian and Polish wastes, so that the whole of northeastern corner of Europe would once again be the realm of barbarian Germania, magnificently impenetrable, densely wooded, filled with the great beasts that Göring loved to hunt on his own estate at Rumminten, elk and stag, wolf and lynx. And the picture on the, both pictures on the right, well, particularly the picture on the right, I'm actually not sure about the one on the left, shows Göring actually where else at Białowieża. Most of all, Göring, who mounted the most extraordinary exhibition of hunting and game trophies the world has ever seen, and I hope will ever see, in Berlin in 1936, most of all, Göring wanted to hunt the Wisent, the great Lithuanian bison. In fact, his ambitions for eugenic design led him towards recreating a purely Teutonic bison. And he was so confident on this score, he invited a party of diplomats to his estate in the Karinhalle, east of Berlin, to watch the official rutting, a tribal rite that failed to materialize on demand, the female bison trotting away in shaggy disgust as her stud made pathetic attempts to mount her. In 1938, though, things were looking up for the Reichsjägermeister, master of the hunt, for of course Göring had added this to his titles. In a desperate attempt to ingratiate themselves with the Reich, the Polish government invited the marshal to Białowieża. They were especially proud of the bison, which had been successfully restored to breeding stock after the German army had eaten virtually the entire herd during the occupation of the forest in World War I. So the visit was a terrific success. Göring slaughtered a frightening number of five-point stag, elk, bison and boar, wallowed like a hog in the imperial bathtub that had been put in the hunting lodge by Tsar Alexander III, and cast a beady and covetous eye on Białowieża itself. In the same year, a curious facsimile edition of the manuscript of the Germania appeared in Berlin. Here's the real thing. Photographically copied from the Codex Asinus that belonged to Count Aurelio Baldeschi Baliani in the Marquess citadel town of Jesi, where, irony of ironies, the German Emperor Frederick II had been born. Seldom missing a chance for one-upmanship, Mussolini had shown what he called his Tacito to the Führer, who lusted after the manuscript as passionately as Göring lusted for Białowieża. In fact, the real person who deeply wanted to bring the Codex of the Germania back to the new Germany was Heinrich Himmler, who bizarrely turns out to have thought of himself as a learned philologist. The Count, the Italian Count, was lent on to give the precious Codex just for copying, to loan it, but it returned to his palazzo at the beginning of the war. Only when Mussolini fell and the Marquess was occupied by the German army was a special detachment of SS sent to Jesi. I've got the, here we are, here's the interior of one of Count Baldeschi Baliani's palaces. This is the one in Jesi. To ransack the palazzo in an attempt to hunt down the founding document of German nationality, what Himmler called the birth certificate of the German race. The classics professors with the death's head caps failed, though. There were three palazzi, and it was an amazing sort of shell game play between them. Tremendous corridors in under the town. The Codex survived to linger on in Italy, where it's still lovingly admired from afar by German collectors. Did Goering have better luck with the woods than Hitler with the parchment? Initially, he was thwarted by the fact that in the secret partition map of Poland, drawn up by the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, Białowieża lay firmly in the Soviet zone of occupation. Such a waste of elk. But no sooner had Operation Barbarossa been launched in 1941 than Goering had a special detachment of SS troops and police sent to secure the forest, which henceforth he annexed as his own personal domain. Schelping was installed in the hunting lodge with a corps of foresters with strict instructions to prevent the Wehrmacht from torching the woods in search of partisans or fugitives. Nothing was to be done to disturb what for Goering was the perfect Urwald. On the other hand, all of its human impurities had to be relentlessly scoured so that they could be part of the great ecological remapping of the northeast woodlands. The Jews, of whom there were many thousands in the timber economy of Białowieża, were of course the first to go, disappearing into the Białystok ghetto and then to Treblinka. The Belarusian churches and Polish villages were sacked and burned, their inhabitants deported en masse, with the exception of those few allowed to tend the trees and birds and beasts of the woods as long as their German counterparts needed time to supersede them. Goering never did get to visit the new domain. And though as an act of characteristically spiteful annihilation, German troops burned down the hunting lodges before their final retreat at the end of the war, they did not, perhaps significantly, touch the forest itself. It was turned over to Stalin, who was not much interested in hunting, and then to Khrushchev, who was feverishly interested in hunting, and ordered a replacement lodge of palatial dimensions to house the parties of nomenklatura he was to entertain at Białowieża. Needless to say, alas for the Soviet Empire, the lodge collapsed a week before it was due to open. Now the marchland of the German woods has retreated in one direction, for even East Prussian villages, of course, bear Polish names. The Belarusian frontier is only occasionally manned, and the long presence of the Russians is marked only by the peculiar scar mown along the old border by a monstrous machine designed to preserve a bald strip in the woods where surreptitious fugitives could be seen, caught, or shot. The Poles have reclaimed the forest as their distinctively national patrimony, and the greatest and oldest oaks are named for kings and warriors and poets of their endlessly tragic past. There are even delicate signs of internationalism amidst all this woodland atavism, for UNESCO has finally recognized Białowieża's unique ecology and keeps at least a formal guardianship watching over its priceless inventory of species, many of which already extinct elsewhere. Amazing kinds of hawks and falcons, actually, in the forest you don't find anywhere else. But though the wolf pack of Białowieża these days stalks through the snow with electronic beepers at their throats, it does seem unlikely the forest will ever be a true international ecological laboratory. It's got too much of the history of nations that have imagined themselves inscribed in its woodland depths. There are too many memories carved, sometimes literally on the tree trunks, too many bodies beneath the leaf mould. And even when I was there 3 years ago, a little boy saw something old and glittering amidst the star moss and bent down to pick up a button from a Napoleonic greatcoat, a souvenir from ancient, terrible journeys that nationalism has tracked back and forth in the forest depths. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Simon is going to take some questions now for perhaps 20 minutes, half an hour. If people who are on the balcony could actually come down to the front when they're giving their questions, it would be very helpful, because otherwise people downstairs won't be able to hear. So perhaps someone wants to kick off. Any questions? Begin. Simon. Let me start the ball rolling.
I thought you'd have a reserve, Matthew. Yes.
Well, my reserve, really, Simon, is to ask you something we were talking about a little bit earlier, which is you've presented a new image, it seems to me, of the natural world. We're very used to a dualistic Manichaean world a world view of the environment in which man is pitted against nature. And I wondered where you thought your much more complex and nuanced approach will lead, and how your own views on that debate have progressed since you wrote the book.
Tony Matthew, I wish I could take credit for that, but actually maybe in European environmental history or something it looks more striking. But as a matter of fact, there was a kind of growing awareness in America in particular of a sort of history which, a great writer on the environment, a man called John Brinkhoff Jackson, who's written, I recommend, magnificent set of essays called Discovering the Vernacular Landscape. It's what he calls kind of humanist landscape history, a landscape history which is sort of unashamed of the track of humanity proceeding through it. Will happen, is that so much seems to have been at stake, in particular, for both environmental history and the environmental movement, at which I'm a really serious and passionate partisan, actually, in this polarization, in the sort of rescue of nature being contingent on us remaking our humanity, giving ourselves a new culture, because it's seen that both Marxist socialism and liberal capitalism seem to have done awful things to the planet, that the call, particularly among deep ecologists, as they call themselves in America, radical ecologists, is for a fundamental kind of mass conversion, a conversion to a kind of new, a radical new sort of way that we describe our community. And I suppose the gist of what I'm saying is, it strikes me, if you demand that, actually, as a kind of condition for repair and restoration, for actually preventing the worst from happening, it's the utopian solution is sort of bound to fail, which is not to say that this book was really conceived as a kind of, sort of polemical exercise, sort of remaking green rhetoric, although I hope it actually will contribute to that. The book is basically not in any sense tended to dilute a kind of alarm, actually, about our relationship with the natural world. It truly isn't, but it's meant to say that because so much of our own history has been a complicated celebration, or in the case of Germany, less a celebration, a very complicated engagement between the things that make us a human society, nationalism, our work, our memories, our sense of what a homeland is, because of that very centrality in human experience, it ought to be possible to draw down on that human experience to actually be more sensitive about the landscape. The mass conversion to whatever might be the alternative out there, it seems to me, not the necessary condition. We simply have to re-examine, the richness of our own past. Since John Muir, conceivably since Thoreau, and actually I think there's a much more gregarious and sociable Thoreau than one usually thinks about, but certainly since John Muir, his greatest apostle, founder of the Sierra Club in America, environmentalism has walked away from history holding its nose. I mean, it's really said, history is dirt, blunder, filth, it's the car park, it's toxic waste, that's what history has done to us. And what I'm trying to say is, there are other histories to recover which might give us the opposite kind of faith.
Did you have a question at the back? Could you speak up a little bit? Sorry, it's a bit difficult here.
Well, I wish it's very Eurocentric because it's the book is sufficiently kind of panoramic as it is. There were certain places, and I'm just not quite, another life. I should have spent that other lifetime and then done it. However, there is one moment, but you're quite it's a shame in a way in which. This is not, in fact, I thought and even presumed to speak a bit about other cultures' definitions taught by people who know much more. The one place where I do think it's of the utmost importance is in the chapters on sacred mountains. The mountain section called Rock is an attempt to say, to investigate this casual, this commonplace that what we do with mountains, some of us here were born in 45 and were primary schoolers in 1953. The conquest of Everest. Remember, the conquest of Everest happens the same week as the Queen is crowned. That what you do with mountains is conquer them. So I take actually mountain climbing, but more particularly Guts and Borglum's Mount Rushmore's, the absolute place where men in particular, inscribe their ego, or, you know, take appropriate topography to put their face on it, to put their whole, and contrast that with the chapter is about, actually, I mean, the sort of, I don't even have a twist right at the front, but actually the chapter begins with telling the story of a wonderful scheme, which was an attempt to put the great American feminist Susan B. Anthony's head on Mount Rushmore. I found this, yes, it failed, but for a while, it's a wonderful woman called Rose Arnold Powell who wanted to do this, and she converted Eleanor Roosevelt, and there was a bill that went through Congress, actually, to do that. They didn't, you know, Guts and Borglum, alas, member of the Ku Klux Klan, not a deeply committed feminist. Alas, unlikely to have this happen. But what I do is, to come back to your question, excuse me, is to contrast that with the mountain as a place for disembodiment, which I took from Chinese landscape painting, in particular Taoist masters and Taoist philosophers, that actually you, oddly enough, you climb a mountain in order to be removed actually from the carapace of your body and to actually sort of dissolve through gathering, getting the right elixir of wild mushrooms and herbs and cooking the hell out of it. You could then enter this shamanic trance-like state and actually vaporously emerge with great cosmic nothing. I thought that was kind of wonderful, extreme, utter extreme opposite. And what the next move that chapter says is, actually, there is a very powerful Western tradition, which, while never Taoist, always looks to and invokes the mountain as a place where you, instead of having omniscience, you have your rationality disturbed and scrambled, and ultimately you survey yourself in a rather horrified way as of puny insignificance, a tradition that goes from, you know, from Christian tradition all the way through to 20th century mysticism.
Might I ask a question about this business of conflict?
It is. I was well aware of it, and it was another tradition that I just felt. The answer is I don't know about it. I know that it's the case, and if in fact I had been, you know, properly dutiful and actually assimilated the learning that deals with these different traditions, a very important conclusion, which I was much too cowardly to sort of march towards, would be a discussion of actually how universal these nature myths are. If you ask me my crude, illiterate hunch, I do absolutely think they're universal. I think they're universal not in the way Jung imagined it, as a kind of universally psychic imprint of the way we respond to the terror of nature. I think they're kind of extraordinary, come from a great single cultural stem, which we can actually historically and archaeologically trace. And the stem actually produces different varieties that, you know, for example, I talk about the myth of Osiris, the mutilated, dismembered god whose, you know, torn body produces the blood that is held to create a fertility cult of the Nile in Egyptian religion. But, of course, there is Tammuz, who does the same in Mesopotamian tradition. There are Mesoamerican traditions that look very much the same. And we have the myth of Osiris not through any Egyptian source in the first place, but through the Greek source of Plutarch. So all these things, I didn't want to. It's an incredibly hard and problematic and probably very important issue about whether we share a common kind of psychology of nature cults. But in order to do it, you know, if I'd tried to do that, someone would say, oh, but there's the aboriginal philosophy of the swamp that you forgot. And I would have forgotten it too, you know. So I just didn't attempt to do that. But it's a failing in the book, I can see.
Question at the back.
When you talk about mountains, it's rather interesting that between Glasgow and Edinburgh, there's a mountain that's called Cairn Patrick, which has got 3,000 years of history, which in fact seems to cross all cultural borderlines. Starts in prehistory and ends up in the Christian era. And it seems that something must have drawn people to that particular place, which is just a very high mountain with a great cairn on the top of it. And it has, even today, when I visited it 2 years ago, this incredible power when you get up there of feeling drawn to this place. And it seems that it isn't just a single philosophy,
Thank you for that example. I mean, most interesting of all is, of course, back to the forest in the extraordinary move that organized Christianity makes, instead of actually committing itself to extirpating all forms of tree worship, to kind of co-opting it. And there's a chapter called The Verdant Cross, which is about images of the cross, Christ crucified, not just on a kind of wooden tree, but actually a tree in leaf and fruit. So, I mean, what you say suggests that, you know, the kind of intense magnetism, really, of these sorts of places transcends very often formal theologies. And theologies need to, you know, they're very shrewd, really, actually, about sort of co-opting these things. I truly think that. Which is why I think, you know, one of the main things that makes environmental, radical ecologists so cross is that Judeo-Christian tradition, which indeed there is no fudging Genesis, says the world is given for our subjugation, our pleasure, and our use. But of course, the Judeo-Christian tradition has to, in the end, coexist with the Greco-Hellenic tradition and the Egyptian tradition. And what I try and show in the chapter on rivers is amazingly how Pope Innocent X in Rome in 1650 commissions Bernini to do this great fountain that is supposed to sort of Christianize pagan traditions about the river, the fountain of the four rivers, and directly co-opts an Egyptian obelisk. The obelisk is right there next to it, as you probably know, those of you who've been in the Piazza Navona. And they're brought together in precisely this kind of extraordinary, kind of fruitful, folded way.
Question there. Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. I think it is above all an emblem. It's a consolation for our own miserable mortality. And I think it's why trees at a certain point in cultural history become thought to be fitting places vegetables ought to indeed embellish cemeteries, because they sort of, in some sense, speak of an endurance, belong a mortal life. Are you talking about literally Australian Aboriginal peoples, treeless?
The Australian Aboriginals and the American Plains Indians.
Well, Plains Indians, by definition, live in a virtually treeless landscape, don't they? So, actually, the mountain, that's the alternative, the tumulus, you know, which is the other pole of burial with earth, actually, the mound can be big mounds, or they can indeed be whole mountains themselves, actually. But I think it is to do with, you know, the rock, as it were, being rock of ages, and that a tree itself, you can see, unlike a rock, you can actually see, sometimes trees growing, but you have a sense that you will never see, if you see one planted, you will never see its maturity. It's a very powerful thing, I think.
Question on the balcony.
If you move away from the micro effect of rocks and trees and mountains to the macro effect of gross landscapes, how do you explain, and if you are saying that landscape civilizations and development of human history, how do you explain the major differences of landscape between Egypt and Italy and Europe, Northern Europe, and the civilizations that grew out of Earth? Very different landscapes, but very major civilizations.
Wait a minute, you're saying different landscapes, different nations. That rather makes the point, doesn't it?
But if you're generating, if you're saying that a certain type of landscape generates civilization, generates development of history, generates history in itself, how do very, very different landscapes generate civilizations in their own right? I mean, the Roman civilization...
It must be late in the evening, but I don't see the problem, actually. I should preface it by saying that I don't, in a sort of simple way, say that, you know, take a forest and it will produce a particular kind of culture. I mean, the sort of lengthy space I actually take up in the book, half the book is about forests, is actually devoted to saying that actually forest spaces can be conceived for other reasons, reasons that are to do with, the kind of ethnic occupation of America, America's sort of ethnic and demographic history, sort of, and indeed the original implantation of Puritan culture, which did indeed conceive of the forest wilderness as a filthy, barbaric place. That will conceive forest in a sort of very different way than Germany conceived of forest. Forest will, to begin with, be an enemy of Americanness, whereas it will be a home to Germanness. In other words, I don't want to make kind of simple, you know, correlation. It's all sorts of other things that I try and describe in the book, actually. It's a very, very churlish answer to your question to say, it's late, by the book, you know, actually. But I do try and complicate it. I do try and answer the question a bit in the book.
I'm going to take two more questions. Could we have a gentleman there, followed by a lady at the front?
Oh, there you are. Yeah. Oh, Olduvai Gorge, and so, yeah. Mm. No, I'm looking at my producer, Tony, over there, who in early stage said, we've got to talk about this, didn't you? We've got to talk about it in the film. And I said, oh, you know, it's a stretch. I don't think, I don't have the kind of paleontology, you know. The answer is that important? It's a fascinating question. I actually would love to, you know, be on a panel or talk to or be educated by. The trouble is, you know, I'm working with what I, you know, initially are speculative documents, paintings. I'm trying to stick. I mean, in this kind of fantastic kind of, you know, trot through sort of space and time, really, I'm working with people who have self-consciously themselves said, look, this is the forest of your ancestors. This is the bloodstream, the River Thames is the bloodstream of your. Camden writes a, you know, a poem, his Britannia is about the waters of England. So I thought the book is, you know, risky enough, actually, that made me want to sort of stick to people who themselves self-consciously articulate that claim, sort of extrapolate from what, you know, I couldn't do it, but I'm not saying it's not an incredibly intriguing question. It's David Attenborough land, sort of, really. But
final question from the lady in the blue at the front.
I want to come back to Australia.
Right. Yes. Yes. No, it's fantastic. I haven't. It's a wonderful subject. There is, I'm sure you know, a terrific book which almost completely, I mean, it doesn't deal completely with the wonderful questions you raised, Paul Carter's book, you know, called The Road to Botany Bay. Oh, it's a wonderful book, yeah, and it's exactly, it's slightly, we're in the forest of hermeneutic signs, sort of a bit in that book, but he is a beautiful writer as well as an intellectually sophisticated one. That is the subject. It doesn't quite, I think, speak completely to the things you say, as a matter of fact, but it is that sort of was one of the most interesting sort of role models in this kind of work I had. So.
Well, I'm sure we could go on all night, but I'd like to take this opportunity of wrapping up and thanking you very much on behalf of the Times and Dylan's for coming. If you want to get a signed copy of the book, Simon will be out front just afterwards, so it's an opportunity not to be missed. But I'm sure you'd like to join me in thanking Simon Sharma for an incredibly stimulating talk.